Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about empowering each of us with the perspective and tools to grow and change. You know, almost 4 years ago, a few of my friends and I were sitting in a room talking about how we could help people see themselves in a new way. And we said, let's create a simple podcast that focuses on helping people open their eyes to their true potential. So we got started, and here we are almost 4 years later. Along the way, we've had hundreds of thousands of downloads of this podcast, and we're thrilled that it's helping some of you live a happier life. So today, wherever you are as you listen, in the car, at the gym, or at your desk, hopefully this podcast will give you a new perspective that you can use to think and live better. And when you're done listening, share this podcast with someone you know. It just may be what they need in their life today. Let's get started. Today, I'd like to talk about mountains and molehills. Rosalind Russell famously said, "Flops are a part of life's menu, and I've never been a girl to miss out on any of the courses." This is the way I feel, and maybe you feel sometimes. We all make mistakes. We all fail sometimes. But the truth is, failures tend to have a shelf life, and we, although flawed at times, are designed to adapt and overcome. And almost all failures are not mountains, but molehills in the valley of life, unless we make them mountains. For 6 to 8 decades, a landmark study has been underway at Harvard University. The participants in this study, who were students and young adults in the 1920s, were interviewed and given health exams throughout their lives to see what factors lead to health and happiness. The results were surprising, revealing things that the researchers didn't anticipate. In fact, they reveal the secret to living a happy life. Longitudinal studies, such as this Harvard study, are the most difficult to conduct, but they yield the richest information. You see, a typical research study takes a measurement at a single point in time, a cross-section of data. But longitudinal studies use repeated observations of the same people over long periods of time, often decades. They follow the same cohort, a group of like-kind people, over a lifetime to see the actual end result. If you want to see the true impact of poverty, follow poor children into their adult years. If you want to see the impact of being a twin, follow sets of twins for a lifetime. But because of the cost and logistics involved, very few in-depth longitudinal studies are ever conducted. The study of adult development at Harvard University has followed and studied three cohorts of men and women since the 1920s. The Harvard cohort was a group of socially advantaged Harvard graduates. The inner city cohort was made up of 456 Boston youth sent to reform school and 500 boys who at the age of 14 hadn't been in reform school. The Terman women cohort was a selection of California school-age children with IQs over 140. Participants in these studies were interviewed and given a physical exam every 2 to 5 years. The study not only examined physical health, but also tracked a host of other factors in an attempt to determine what caused or detracted from the developmental, emotional, and mental health of the participants. The study revealed the causes of good or poor health. Interestingly, ancestral longevity, cholesterol, or stress didn't determine the quality of health beyond age 50. Rather, smoking, alcohol, weight, and exercise were the highest predictors of whether someone would be healthy. While smoking was the biggest contributor to poor health, exercise was the leveling factor. Consistent exercise led to greater health despite other harmful factors. Even for those who were overweight, if they included regular exercise in their life, they had significantly improved health and longevity. While health was one emphasis of the study, the most surprising results came when researchers discovered what factors led to happiness in life. At first glance, one would think the Harvard cohort, with average incomes of over $105,000 during their working years and high social standing, would be happier because of their wealth or circumstances. Or one might think that the inner city cohort, with average incomes below $35,000, would reveal poverty leads to unhappiness. You would think the Terman women with IQs over 140 would make more intelligent life choices and have better health and longevity. But the study revealed income and IQ were not significant factors in determining happiness. As the research progressed and the participants aged, other factors than wealth and IQ began to emerge. Like all of us, the study participants made choices, some of them bad. They also had bad things happen to them in life that were beyond their control. Over time, researchers observed it's not the bad things that happen to us that determine our happiness, but what we choose to do with those things that matters. In fact, some of the happiest individuals made bad choices or had devastating illness, loss, and even other bad things happen to them during their lifetime. And the bad experiences themselves were not a predictor of happiness or unhappiness. For almost all participants who were rated as happy, their poor choices or circumstances set up their next successful step in life. Rather than a setback, they used their failures as a setup to living the rest of their life more happily. Researchers in the study call this adaptive coping style and describe it as the capacity to turn lemons into lemonade and not turn molehills into mountains. This positive adaptation to life played a significantly greater role than genetics, wealth, race, or other factors in determining how happy people were later in life. It isn't so much what they started with, what mistakes they made, or what happened to them that influenced their happiness in life. It's what they did with what happened to them that mattered. One study participant, Bill Graham, suffered years of abuse as a child. Researchers described his early years as filled with starvation, abuse, lack of love, and aloneness. His mother gave him up to foster care when he was 3.5. When Bill was 6 years old, his father was committed to a state hospital for psychosis. He was beaten by his foster parents. He said, "I always knew someone was coming to visit because I got fed and clean." In the researcher's scoring system, only 16 of the 456 inner-city cohorts suffered a worse childhood than Bill. Amazingly, in subsequent research visits, researchers observed that Bill went on to mold a rich and happy life for himself. He married well. His wife was unselfish, kind, loving, and generous. She was dependable and considerate. She was devoted to him, and they created a family of their own. And his life became immensely satisfying. In a gesture of incredible charity, he took his father, the same man who neglected him as a child, out of the inhumane conditions of the state hospital to live with them. During the lonely, isolated final years of his mother's life, he regularly visited the very woman who had placed him in foster care. At the age of 53, Bill suffered a devastating blow. His wife died of cancer. Her death was overwhelming to him. He was hospitalized for major depression. But that wasn't where his story ends. At 58, 5 years after his wife's death, he found a new mission in life, helping others who suffered as he did. And he went on to create a ministry. He teaches how to help people live in peace. Researchers rated him in their highest happiness category, despite his being stricken by bladder cancer, kidney failure, and a triple bypass heart surgery. He said, "Learn to live in thankfulness, looking back at what you have had and what you didn't have, and most of all, what you do have now." You see, life is full of choices. Just wander up to the Baskin-Robbins ice cream counter and you'll see a metaphor for life. What flavor's right for you? What will make you the most satisfied? Unfortunately, the consequences of most of life's choices linger longer than the sweet taste of cookie dough ice cream. And the one thing is certain, the more we choose, the more likely we are to choose poorly now and then. We make bad judgments, lack experience, misread, misinterpret, and mistake the wrong thing for the right thing. Life is tough, and life teaches us there are consequences for bad choices. And because we don't have a clear knowledge or have the ability to see around corners, we will make bad decisions from time to time. We choose whom to marry. But most of us make that choice without full information. As we get down the road, we find maybe sometimes that it's not a perfect marriage. We learn that choosing has consequences. We make financial investments without full information. When we choose poorly, we suffer losses. We make career decisions in haste. And if we do, and it's the wrong decision, we again suffer the consequences. Life also tosses challenges our way that are beyond our control. Illness, a downturn in the economy, accidents, or family hardships caused by the poor choices of someone else can all lead to major life setbacks or disappointments. The truth is, rain will fall on all of us. And it's not the fact that the rain fell that's important. It's what we did after we got wet that determines whether we're happy. As Longfellow wrote, "Thy fate is the common fate of all. Into each life some rain must fall. Some days must be dark and dreary." But just like the researchers from Harvard study learned, it isn't what happens to us that matters. It's what we do with what happens to us that makes the difference. Years ago, John Maxwell wrote a book entitled Failing Forward. In it, he writes, "The difference between average people and achieving people is their perception of and their response to failure. This impacts every aspect of their lives. You see, failure is not an event, it's a process." Maxwell suggests that we are too quick to take an isolated event in life and use it to define us or define our life. Most of us are apt to look at a recent failure in life and label ourselves by it, and that's easy to do. But a single event doesn't have to define who we are. Instead, we can consider our life over time and look at who we've become as a result of our cumulative choices. Not long ago, I had a student come into my office in tears. She was distraught because she failed a major test and, as a result, was likely to fail her college class. She'd have to take the class again. In her words, she felt like a failure. I asked her what she'd learned, and she said, "I've learned that when I procrastinate doing my class assignments and don't participate in a study group, I don't do as well." "Wonderful," I said. "Then it was worth it to fail the class." In the midst of her failing, she couldn't see that she'd been armed with the wisdom and memory that could give her the strength and smarts to do well in every class thereafter. She had become different because of her mistake. Life gives us the gift of failing to teach us what we need to do to be happy. In fact, I believe God blesses us with failure tailored specifically to our individual needs and future opportunities. If we respond to and learn from that failure in the right way, we have exactly what God intended for us to have in order to be happy and become the person He wants us to become. In his book, Maxwell tells the story of the 1954 opening day in Major League Baseball. The Milwaukee Braves and the Cincinnati Reds were squaring off in the opening game, with two rookies starting for the first time, one of them on each team. The rookie for the Reds hit four doubles and led his team to victory. The rookie for the Braves went 0-for-5. Where were those rookies years later? The rookie for the Reds, Jim Greengrass, never became a well-known player. What about the rookie for the Braves who went 0-for-5 in his major league debut? That was Hank Aaron, who became the best home run hitter in the history of baseball at the time. Aaron didn't let a single game define his career. How many of us now have attempted something new only to fail miserably and then end up never trying again? We learned from the Harvard cohort study that the difference between those who succeed in life and those who don't, between those who find happiness and those who don't, it really comes down to how they respond to failure. So, do you fail forward? Does your failure lead to seeing and doing things differently? Or do you get swallowed up in your mistakes and fail to emerge more wise and capable? If your business hasn't gone as well as you wanted lately, do you learn from it and become better? In 2006, I led a large-scale adult development research study among adults in the U.S. and Canada. It was to determine the factors that led them to, among other things, social and emotional maturity. And one of the major findings from the study was that many adults get stuck as a result of their failures. They become so caught up in and embedded in their failure that they can't find a way out. For example, some people go through divorce and emerge having learned valuable lessons, thereby making better marriage choices later in life. They seem to have the wherewithal to keep the wisdom gained, but shrug off the mistake itself. Others, however, never get over the hurt, the emotional scarring, or need to retaliate. They vow never to get themselves into such a painful situation again. They begin to relate most things in life through the perspective of their bad marriage. They say things like, since my divorce, I've been, or my ex-husband doesn't think I can. You see, they see life through the lens of their past. This way of thinking isn't limited to divorce in the study. I studied many adults who were stuck in life for other reasons. Personality conflicts, habits, addictions, and an unwillingness to move beyond their way of thinking kept some adults from becoming the person they wanted to become. Overwhelmingly, those who couldn't emerge from their situations in life felt like a failure, and they let it define them and their future. So, how do you learn from failure without feeling like a failure? How can you emerge from life setbacks and set up a way to move forward? What we learned in our research was people who emerged from their failures had two things that other people didn't have. First, they had a friend that helped them. And second, they had a source of inspiration that elevated their vision of who they could become. Emotionally healthy people have a particularly useful skill. They have the capability to stand back and view themselves and their situation as if they're looking through a camera at themselves, like a third party. They can think about and describe their own behavior as if they were independent from themselves. They can see without bias what they need to do differently. They are objective, not subject to their behavior. One study participant who moved beyond divorce said, "I took a step back and thought, why did I settle? I got married because all my friends were getting married. I can see how I let myself get into a situation I didn't want to be in." When we can step back and independently assess our situation, it gives us the ability to choose what to do with what's happened to us. However, it's very difficult to step away from our embeddedness and our view of life from that perspective. That's why we need someone to help us. For example, the divorcee who successfully failed forward had a father who helped her through her thought process and supported her unconditionally. He helped her see things clearly, independently. He was patient and helped her see her way through. In addition to a friend, study participants who failed forward had a source of ongoing inspiration. For some, it was a deeper connection with God. Scripture was key for them. For others, it was inspiration from good books or uplifting messages in their daily reading. One of the key conclusions from this study is when we combine the learning we gain from life's mistakes with ongoing reading and inspiration, we are more likely to overcome and fail forward. Why? Because that inspiration gives us a new pattern of thinking. You see, our brains are constantly organizing information. Our brain automatically takes what happens to us, even complex input like feelings, and stores that information in a way that allows us to make sense of it. Because of the enormous complexity of life, our brains store and retrieve information differently from one person to another. As a result, our minds store and retrieve information from a conglomerate of input organized by our frame of reference. Our brains use what we constantly think about as the catalog system for input and retrieval of information. For example, if a child has been verbally abused, when he interacts with other children, his brain likely tries to fit the images and feelings of interacting with others into his prevailing framework, which was formed based on verbal abuse. His way of relating to the world was framed by his way of relating at home. As a result, he may act out in ways perceived as antisocial or inappropriate. His catalog system never lets him move beyond his abuse. He's constantly reminded of it. As adults, we're no different. If, following a divorce, we replay in our mind the reasons we're unattractive, ugly, or full of feelings of mistrust, then our brains begin to create a frame of reference based on those thoughts and feelings. Any new input from life gets cataloged for future reference based on those feelings of mistrust or trust. After that, we begin to relate to people based on our mistrust for them rather than other healthy ways. And when we do, we shut out other ways of interacting, and we narrow our thinking. When we're in the midst of failure, we need to give our brain a framework based on true principles. If we're not reading, listening, or feeding our brains new positive sources of thought, our brains use our preoccupation with our failures as the map for storing and retrieving information. However, if we're feeding our minds with thoughts and ideas that give us hope, then those are the thoughts that will be recalled and used. This concept is called anchoring. When our brains don't have a well-defined basis for making a decision, it relies on whatever information is available. We then use that information as the beginning point for making sense of our experiences, the anchor. And when a person's way of thinking is anchored in hope or the possibility of becoming better, then all future thoughts come and go in our brain based on that framework. That's why a friend can help us talk through life's challenges and create a framework for thinking. That's why using God's framework as our framework allows us to think like Him rather than our usual thought pattern. We aren't relying on our own embedded frame of reference. Makes sense, doesn't it? Perhaps the best perspective I ever learned about failure was the concept of halftime. Thank heaven games don't end at halftime. And if they did, the record books would be written differently. If Super Bowl 44 between the Indianapolis Colts and the New Orleans Saints ended at halftime, the Colts would have won, and the city of New Orleans, struggling to emerge from hurricane devastation, wouldn't have a victory to boost the city's morale and image. At halftime in Super Bowl 51, the Falcons were ahead of the New England Patriots by 21-3, but the Patriots won. In Super Bowl 57, the Eagles were beating the Chiefs at halftime, but the Chiefs came back and won. Halftime is perhaps the most important part of the game. What do teams do at halftime? Well, they review what worked and didn't work. They make adjustments. They make new plans for doing things better. They get inspired. They get refreshed and prepared for their now more familiar opponent. They use what they've learned to get out and play better. And life is very much the same. We can step aside, go into the locker room, so to speak, and assess how we're doing in life. Now we're more familiar with our opponent. We can make adjustments, get refreshed, and begin anew. At halftime, there isn't anything you can do about the first half score. It's done. It's in the record books. At halftime, you can't spend any time wishing things were different. You can only take what you've learned and make urgent plans for change. Life's halftime is the same. The more time spent on the new game plan, the better we'll be. Think about the coach of a game. Imagine if a coach's reaction to mistakes in the first half was to be depressed. Can you see the coach reliving and reviewing the mistakes over and over again? Can you see him sitting in the locker room, head in hands, wondering why bad things always happen to him? If he reacted like this, he wouldn't have time to get a new game plan or focused on what's next. A good coach knows there's a second half to be played, and it's not won or lost on a single play. So he keeps his head in the game and prepares for the next half. A good coach doesn't ignore mistakes either. He uses them for instruction and learning at the appropriate time. He faces up to the fact that his design or his plan didn't work. He uses what he's learned, recalibrates, and calls a new play or sets a new game plan in place. Life is very much the same. There's little value in reliving mistakes over and over again, and there's little value in running from our mistakes. So, if you're facing a setback, remember it's halftime. Get your game plan written down. Decide your course of action. Your written plan will guide you from feeling like a failure to moving forward as a result of the failure. You see, someone once coined the phrase, "Don't make mountains out of molehills." Molehills are small mounds of dirt left when a mole digs up a hole in the ground. We make mountains from molehills when we blow things out of proportion or when we overreact to the small inconveniences that come our way. If we get delayed in traffic or children leave a mess in the kitchen, we may tend to overreact and we give away our power to be happy. Have you ever known someone who has the habit of making mountains out of molehills? It seems like they're very rarely, if ever, happy. And because life is full of small inconveniences, they are constantly reacting and overreacting each day. So, what can you do to avoid making mountains out of molehills? Well, keep your focus on the big picture. The more you focus on small issues, the more you talk about them, the bigger they become in your eyes. Recently, a man I knew bought an $80,000 European car. It was a beautiful car. It had gorgeous leather seats and the interior was stunning. The car was fast, fuel efficient, and had every bell and whistle a person could want. After having the car for a week, he noticed the heated seats were slow to heat up. And every time he got in the car, he was frustrated that the heated seats were so slow. He complained about it all the time. He couldn't drive the car without thinking about it. Finally, he traded in the beautiful car, lost over $10,000 on his trade, and bought another car just because he was frustrated with the heated seats. The funny thing was he later learned the switch to his European car worked backwards from the American-made cars he had owned, and each time he thought he was turning up these heated seats, he was actually turning them down. He gave up a beautiful car that he loved in every other respect because he couldn't stop focusing on one small issue. We do the same with people and ourselves. We can focus so long on someone's shortcomings or our own that we can't see all the wonderful qualities they possess. If we focus on what we don't like about someone, we'll soon get to the point where we can't see anything good in them at all. And the same goes for ourselves. We can focus on our own shortcomings to the same outcome. You know, it may be these mountains, the mountains we make from molehills, that faith can move. In Matthew, the Lord said that even with the smallest faith, that of a mustard seed, we could move mountains. You see, when we exaggerate the bad in ourselves or others, we make mountains out of molehills. But we can move those mountains when we have faith in ourselves, in God, and other people. When we magnify their strengths, we faithfully remove the mountains that stand in their way. So, let go of the small things. Value your small missteps. They make us better. Don't sweat the small stuff. And watch. You will see that God and life really have given you space and time to make mistakes, to learn and grow, and to understand that life is full of flaws, but perfect in its ability to help us learn and be happy. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to share this podcast with a friend. And join us next week for another podcast as we learn to open our eyes to who and what we can become.